because it's always interesting to us when desire to build something is also personally driven and there's an internal passion and a reason why an entrepreneur builds something.
And while I was developing the cardiac models, my father was diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer. The problem was my dad's unique. Every patient with cancer is unique. And looking back, if we would have had the models that exist today in our company, likely my father would have made a different treatment choice.
Hey everyone, welcome to Brains Behind AI, the show where we meet the innovators, entrepreneurs, and the real brains behind some of the most successful AI startups. We ask them about their journey from coming up with the idea to finding the product market fit, and from their experience, draw a set of principles that we can take away to ours. This is your host, Ari. Thank you for spending time with us. And now, let the show begin. Hello and welcome to another episode of Brains Behind AI. I am Ari Yacobi. I have with me my co-host, Natalie Thomas. And we have a very special guest, Bobby Palmer, with us. Bobby is a healthcare AI entrepreneur. And as most of you who know me know that I get extra excited when I get a healthcare AI startup on the show. And today is one of those shows. So Natalie, let's introduce Bobby to the audience.
Absolutely. Bobby Palmer is the president and CEO of Potentiometrics, an Austin, Texas-based healthcare analytics company. The company's data analytics and artificial intelligence platforms helps providers, payers, and medical technology companies inform personalized treatment plans by comparing patient-level outcome data related to survival, quality of life, and cost of care. Bobby creates the company's vision and strategic direction to develop the multi-institutional real-world outcome registries that enable the creation of its unique personalized AI platforms. As a business owner and CEO for over 20 years, as well as 2 decades of experience in data analytics, Bobby has obtained funding for and managed numerous multi-million dollar enterprises. Bobby also received his MBA from Washington University in St. Louis. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bobby, before we dive into your startup, can you take a minute to tell our audience about your personal background and how your personal background was a trigger to what you do today and your startup? Because it's always interesting to us when desire to build something is also personally driven and there's an internal passion and a reason why an entrepreneur builds something. So if you can take a moment to tell our audience about your personal background and how it influenced you to build what you have today.
The story goes back to my start in healthcare. I was working with a large group of cardiac surgeons and developing predictive analytics for cardiac surgery outcomes. And my background training is in statistical analysis, mainly economic background, so looking at developing risk models. I was adapting many of those approaches that, going back almost 20 years ago, were historically used mainly in the financial services industry to medical. And while I was developing the cardiac models, my father was diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer. So 70, otherwise healthy, he jogged 5 miles a morning of his diagnosis. We met with his physicians and we were told cancer spread to the liver and lung. So very difficult diagnosis, but I'm surrounded by physicians. I'm building risk models. Certainly there's something that we can do and adapt some of the work that we've been doing in cardiac to cancer, which I assumed would have been much more advanced than the work that we were doing in cardiac. But what I found is there was a dearth of information available to us that was specific to my father. So metastatic patients, hard to find information on. Pretty much anything that we were able to find, I felt like throwing up after I would read through it. So I was pretty much ineffective just from an emotional standpoint and also from an analytic standpoint, my ability to support my father. So what we reverted to, what we did, is surrounded by physicians, I put together a roundtable group of very experienced surgeons, clinicians, oncologists, general practitioner docs to, what would you do type question, which I hear over and over again among patients. And what we landed on was basically the physicians, and looking back, I would do the same thing. basically pushed us towards, these are the guidelines for patients that have a diagnosis similar to your father, and this is what we would recommend. The problem was my dad's unique. Every patient with cancer is unique. And looking back, if we would have had the models that exist today in our company, likely my father would have made a different treatment choice. And what happened with him, we moved towards a course of treatment, which we did with the best information we had at the time. The result was my dad died in about a year, and he really died of the side effects of treatment. And looking back, that last year of his life was really difficult in the hospital, more than not, multiple surgeries, multiple infections. We would have had a very complex decision to make with the tools that we have, the information we provide, that would have set us more based upon, you have a challenging diagnosis, it's much more challenging than we knew. And our outlook was much more optimistic than it should have been, and it pushed us towards treatment that resulted counterintuitively in the suboptimal outcomes in my dad.
I see. So as you started looking at your father's case in case study and started evaluating and started seeing the gaps, where did you go from there?
So one of the problems that exist in cancer care is, if you look at the outcomes of clinical trials, they answer questions around efficacy, and they're really important questions, and there's nothing wrong with the way that these questions are structured on the basis of clinical trials. But if you look at the trial participants, they're tightly controlled. They're literally science experiments that are performed on the outcomes of these patients. But in the meanwhile, when you look in the waiting room, patients tend to be older. They have other diseases, comorbidities. They have different stages of disease, and combinations of all of those factors make the participants in the real world quite different than those that are in the clinical trials, who tend to be younger, less racially and ethnically diverse, and healthier in general than the populations that treated for cancer. With more grain of information, the goal of what we're doing is really not about directing any individual towards a given regimen of care or treatment decision. These are multifactorial and deeply personal choices that individuals are forced to make, but rather give them transparency, give them the best information available to chart what is, for every patient at the end of the day, an unknown future course.
Interesting. So now you have this analysis and you've started working through some of that. When did you feel a calling where you said, this is a startup here, this is a real opportunity, and I need to go for it?
For two decades, I've worked in developing models for financial services. I've done work in multiple industries, including healthcare. But when I first saw the healthcare data, I'd never seen the level of variation that was presented to me there, and also the impact on people. So at the end of the day, doing important work, we all have a limited amount of time that we can dedicate to what we do. And I want my time to be spent on something that's very impactful, and looking back would have helped people like my dad. So seeing the variation that existed, I saw a massive opportunity that I wanted to focus my time on.
I was just going to ask, when was that moment for you? How long ago was that?
So I was presented with the cancer data. I saw it for the first time in 2011. So that was really the moment where I saw tremendous variation, and I started building the cardiac models going back to 2004. During that period of time, that I was seeing the variation, but also learning the system, learning about the data. I don't have a medical background or training, so I had to bring on team members that have the clinical understanding that remains a gap. I'm not clinical. But I brought other aspects and understanding of the building risk models that they didn't have experience in.
Got it. So where did you start? I was actually going to go there. Did you go out and start pulling together the team that was going to build this out to do a pilot? Did you go reach out to a client first that you can POC this with? Because it's an interesting problem, right? And the dynamics, you can't really solve it in a silo. You need to partner with the healthcare company. You need the data. You need the record.
Right.
How did you approach that?
Partnering with multiple academic institutions is where I began. So we need access to the core data. and we need access to the core data also with a long enough grain that we can look at comparative outcomes over time. We started combining data sets from multiple institutions that treat patients, I want to say in quotation marks, differently, so that we could look at patients that, for instance, treat higher volumes of patients with radiation and surgery. So now we've got comparisons there. We can look at large data sets, multiple strata of patients from age, from stage perspective, from treatment choices, and start comparing their outcomes. And so it began with that. And then in parallel, how do we best quantify these outcomes from an analytic approach perspective? So one of the important aspects that I wanted to focus on is that this can't be a black box. Patients are looking at this with their physicians. This can't be mystical in how do we get to these outcomes. So while we do have unique IP per se in the way that we put together these models, we've used approaches that are clinically sound and externally validated, so that physician would look at this and say, oh, you're using proportional hazard models. I understand that. I understand how you got these numbers. I understand the base data that you're using, how it's gathered, that there are rules associated with the data that you're gathering. So I know I can trust that a patient that received treatment A actually received that treatment, that a patient that died within this time frame. So we spent a lot of time on really fundamental questions in determining our approach, and then post developing the tools, backtesting and validating externally the tools that we have, so that we're not creating a platform that causes additional confusion. We really want to create transparency, and that's critical to the transparency, is that you can trust the information we provide.
That's great. Can you talk to us about your experience piloting this technology? I ask because healthcare is a complex space. Any new technology must go through a lot of validation before it makes its way through to the patient. So I'm curious what your experience was like piloting it and then scaling the technology out.
Starting with academic centers, we worked with academic centers and doing internal trials of the platform, focusing on certain groups of patients, for instance, newly diagnosed African American women with breast cancer, and having them use the platform and give us their feedback. Was this the information that you would look for? Was it valuable to you? Was it relevant? Do you understand it? There were many underlying questions that we had to answer through these studies. So some of the pushback, for instance, is if you provide patients information about their prognosis, some would say it's too scary. It's something that patients would just want to work with their physicians and would share with their physicians, but they don't want to know. They don't want to ask the individual questions. So what we found was there were groups of patients within our studies that resonated towards wanting this information more than others. So, for instance, engineers, physicians, people with quantitative backgrounds, lights out, they want this information. Some patients are scared, just want their doctor to tell them what to do, and that's okay. We uncovered a group of patients within our studies that surprised me and others in the group as well. Minority, non-English speaking patients also wanted these patients, this information at a very high level, because they believe the system is wired against them and they're getting suboptimal care, which is, if you look at the data and our outcomes, unequivocally they are. If you look at race as a factor of prognosis, adjusting for important factors such as stage, comorbidity, there is a difference, and minority non-English speaking individuals tend to have worse prognosis. So testing it, not just from a tool perspective, but also from a usability and uptake perspective, was an important component. What we're working on now is another important component, is getting this from a scaling perspective. How do we insert this into the clinical workflows so that physicians can easily access it, capture the patient at the right time when they need it after they're newly diagnosed as soon as possible? And integrating is one of the challenges we're working on currently.
That was going to go into one of my next questions of the challenges that you've been encountering, throughout creating this new company and doing your research and collecting data.
I'll start with just change in general is hard. We're introducing information that wasn't available before. So while intuitively it makes sense that I would like to know what are outcomes for individuals similar to me, many times the outcomes will push towards something that's counterintuitive, meaning that patients may not benefit from treatment. So my dad's example, if you input the different treatment options into the model, there's no treatment that improves my dad's prognosis. And in fact, the treatment that he received actually shortened his life, which 4 hours, even though he's an N of one, that's what we experienced with him. The resulting change, and given the variation in outcomes that we see, roughly 30% of patients are not benefiting from the treatment that they're receiving. And therefore, if you think about the treatments that for cancer, they're invasive treatments, and therefore they're not helping, they're harming. So that's pretty challenging information. We're not the only ones that are presenting that. That's pretty well known. But when you think about the different systems in place, like for instance, in the United States, the system is based upon volume of treatment, and the economics are dependent upon more patients coming through the system. So, and now we introduce this tool, which is around transparency, which matches the right treatment to each patient based upon their values. And many times that can lead to less treatment, therefore less revenue to a hospital system, for instance. So that's one of the challenges that we've had to face. Another challenge is how do we get this information to patients in a way that they can consume it, understand it, remember it? So multiple studies have shown that less than 5% of adult patients with cancer can explain what their prognosis is to their physician. So did they understand what the physician told them? The answer is overwhelmingly no. So, and it's not that the physician didn't tell them, but when a patient hears something like, for instance, you have cancer, many times the rest of anything else the doctor says is lost. Now the patient's mind is, oh my God, I'm going to die. What about my family? And even though the physician is doing their best to mitigate those factors and explain prognosis, patient is so terrified. So one of the challenges is how do we bridge that gap to where we're providing information that fundamentally is scary? You have cancer, which is a difficult diagnosis, in a way that a patient can relate, understand, and then also help them self-advocate. So that's been a fundamental challenge in helping patients that have issues with clinical literacy and numeracy understand these factors so that they can have deeper, more meaningful conversations with their clinicians and with their family members to talk about what decision I made and why I made it.
Very interesting. And now let's take a minute to talk about artificial intelligence and machine learning. How are you applying AI and machine learning to the applications that you're building out?
If you look at our models, we have models for 14 different cancer sites. We cover roughly 80% of all adult cancers. Each one of the models, while similar approach as the factors, the variables that we use for our models are specific to each cancer, and the weightings of those variables are very different depending on the cancer. So the learning aspect of our models takes into account, for instance, if you look at a patient who has prostate cancer, and we take into account age, stage of disease, comorbidity, the other diseases that the patient has, and combining those with different treatments or combinations thereof. And what we're relating on a machine learning basis is what are outcomes of similar patients that have received these different treatments over time so that we can show you the 5-year survival rates. So the machine learning aspect comes into play when you think about the population of those patients is changing over time. So in general, the patients are getting older. We're seeing higher levels of comorbidity. We're seeing different stages of diseases, and we're also seeing dynamic nature with respect to what treatments are provided, so new and changing treatments. So our models are training and are updating based upon all these factors interplaying with each other. So for instance, if we see a new immunotherapy drug that comes out, we'll start seeing signals in our model that we're seeing improvements in survival among a subset of patients that are receiving this immunotherapy drug if it's effective, for instance. But now we also need to look at the other factors that are in play. Is there a certain strata of patients where this drug is showing higher levels of effectiveness. And maybe there are certain stages. So for instance, maybe patients with stage 4 disease that are between 45 and 60 that have a lower levels of comorbidity are showing much better outcomes than this. So given all those factors together, if you can think about statistically, what I just laid out is tens, hundreds of millions of combinations of variables that are playing with each other. So without powerful systems of processing speed, we couldn't run the models that we do today. When even 4 or 5 years ago, to compute some of our curves, it would take 10, 15 hours of processing time to compute. Now we're able to compute much faster, and we're also able to add more variables, and we're also able to see how these variables interact with each other in new and dynamic ways. So, and the models are becoming more precise with higher fidelity, and this is proven out with our statistics. So for instance, we look at C statistics as a way of determining whether, in quotation marks, how good these models are, how reflective they are of what's happening. And we're seeing those C statistics improve over time as well.
That's excellent, Bobby. Now, as you build these models out, what was the most challenging part? And I'm thinking holistically, was it getting the right people to work with you? Was it the process? Was it the data? What was the challenging aspect, and how did you tackle that?
Fundamentally, obtaining the data is a challenge. First of all, people are concerned about releasing it. What are you going to do with it? Is it somehow going to reflect on us in a bad way? If you think about if you were part of a hospital system and you've been collecting data, but it's really never been compared to another system's outcome. So you're not sure what are our outcomes at our center compared to another. So that's a challenge, and transparency is hard. And the approach that we've taken is we're not making this public. We're not horse racing hospital A versus hospital B. Rather, by combining multiple centers' outcomes and centers that may do things a little bit differently, we're able to compare and learn from each other. So mitigating that risk early on was difficult, and still today, basically anyone that shares information with us, I'm going personally and speaking with them, working with them. We're going to be, first of all, very respectful of your data from a privacy perspective. That's foundational. I mean, we cannot be identifying patients. We can't do anything with respect to that, but we get the information that's de-identified already, making it so that it's safe to share this information, and that we're supporting a learning system rather than calling out where there may be flaws or gaps, because certainly they exist within every system, but the gaps may be idiosyncratic in that we may see large groups of patients. For instance, the work I did in cardiac surgery, with mortalities would typically come in bunches. Like for many years, a surgeon may not have any patient deaths. And then all of a sudden, in one quarter, they have 4 patients die. And now all of a sudden, they're on the radar screen. What's going on? Your patients are dying. Well, statistically, that's what we would expect to see. But from a human perspective, it just feels like they were bunched, and there must be something going on that's wrong. So that being able to access large data, combine systems together, we're able to smooth those anomalies out.
And have you had to pivot in any way with COVID this year? And have you seen a shift in your data sets?
Yeah, so COVID has been very difficult for cancer patients. So we're going to see a large wave of cancer patients hitting in the future that are going to show up, by definition, later stage patients, because screening isn't occurring at the same levels. Patients that are newly diagnosed are now being delayed in even something as simple as getting staged. So patients that are in the system are continuing to be treated, but even those patients are going through real complexity. So imagine you're going through chemotherapy. By definition, you're immunosuppressed, and now you're thinking about going into your oncologist's offices, and are you going to be exposed to COVID, which could be a lethal exposure for you? So the hesitation factor there, the anxiety that these patients are already going through with cancer, and now you add a whole additional layer, and the isolation layer, has really been devastating to cancer patients. We're expecting, and we will see, over the next months and years, patients presenting with later stage disease that should have gone in for their colonoscopy over the past 6 months that didn't. Patients that should have had a mammogram that didn't. So those are just realities that we're going to have to work through. And it's a sad truth, but we're going to see cancer mortality rates have a bump up in the coming weeks, or in the coming months and years.
Yeah. You bring a very interesting point, right? As because of COVID-19 and this pandemic, while we're focused on taking care of the pandemic, everything else is getting ignored. And one of the concerns I have is, on the other side of it, say towards 2021, towards the end, are we going to have a lot more deaths from other conditions and other things versus COVID because those were ignored and things that are way more critical?
Yeah. So I'll just use the United States numbers. This is an excellent question. Every year, 1.7 million people are diagnosed with cancer in the United States. So many of those cancers are treatable. The vast majority of those patients survive. There's a subset of those patients which have very difficult prognosis. So if you think about pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, difficult to deal with. So if you would delay the prognosis of those patients even months, can have a serious impact on their abilities to survive this. So we're going to see a tailing response within cancer patients. And if I had to quantify the numbers, it wouldn't surprise me if we see excess deaths, meaning patients that are dying that otherwise wouldn't. It would be 50, 100,000 patients from cancer, and that's going to be have a tail because of cancer spreads, treatment spreads over many years. So we're gonna see this for the next 1-5 year time frame. We're gonna see the impact of this, if not longer.
So here's the next question, right? And healthcare is one sector where we need innovation, especially that's data driven and analytics driven more than anywhere else. It's in dire need of innovation. It's ironic that the healthcare is the sector that's slowest in terms of innovating and adapting to change. So what advice do you have for healthcare industry leaders that have important role in healthcare that may be listening to this right now or watching this right now? What would you say to them? How can they help you accelerate, and how can we accelerate our healthcare innovation journey?
One of the major issues in the healthcare sector that I see is, and how long does it take to adopt new technology? So if you look at new treatments, it takes on average over 15 years from trial to acceptance to delivery in the hospital system. So imagine being a patient on the other side of this, and there was a drug that could help you that was produced so many years ago, but you're not aware of it. It's not part of the standard of care, so you don't get it. So that'd be terrible. That's on the drug side. But now let's move to the technology and data side, where we're seeing vast changes in technology, processor speed. All these important factors are changing literally on a monthly basis. And then we're not bringing this new technology to market because of time to adapt technology can be a year before you would even take part in the sales cycle within a hospital system. It takes 1 to 2 years. And so just that alone, from a hospital administrator, from a healthcare plan administrator perspective, if we could move towards a faster speed of app debt adaptation within the different systems, institutions, we could save lives, we could save money, but you're going to have to rework your internal systems and processes to do that. And that's not easy, we understand. But from the outside, for new companies that are coming up with new technologies, for us to withstand a 2-year sales cycle beyond the development period is very difficult from a capital perspective and a team perspective to keep people on board.
And I just wanted to ask, based off that question too, do you have advice for aspiring entrepreneurs who perhaps even want to go into the healthcare space?
I would find areas where there are gaps in care. That's not going to be the hard part. The harder part is going to be find areas where there are gaps in care, and there's also a clear pathway towards reimbursement. So coming up with a new technology and then waiting for CMS to change the rules, or Blue Cross Blue Shield or United Healthcare to change the rules so where you can be reimbursed for that is exquisitely difficult. Being able to play into the existing system, is there a code to reimburse this already? Is there a technology that can fit into the existing code? It moves you so much quicker towards the goal of becoming viable from both a technology and business perspective. So matching those aspects, I think, is a fundamental component of a business plan that I think many times can be glossed over because you get so focused on the clinical need, you don't realize that the other aspect of this could cause you to die 1,000 times before you get to success.
That's great. So looking into the future, as we look beyond this pandemic in 2021 or 2022, where do you see your technology, your business? What does future looks like for you?
Yeah. So we're driving towards a world where every patient that has a complex diagnosis like cancer can ask the question and receive credible information on what are outcomes for individuals similar to me that based upon different treatment choices or combinations thereof, which seemingly is a simple question and seemingly is something that people ought to be able to relate. But if you look at the participants in the trial, they tend to be less racially diverse and now less and younger. But the average cancer patient diagnosis is north of 70. And now those patients typically have diabetes or other diseases, obesity, heart disease. They have complex choices to make, and the challenges that they're facing are multidimensional. So where do I live? Can I keep my job? Can I still watch my kids, my grandkids? We need to provide tools that provide answers, not just to the survival questions, which doctors are key in on and should be, but also taking into account your values, quality of life questions, providing deeper information and that's more relevant and critically, that's personalized to each individual is where I see things moving. And we have the data. We have the underlying technology now that we didn't have in the past. And the data is filling in gaps that doesn't exist. So the future where we're driving to is that. And we want to be the company that's driving this, starting in cancer, but expanding into other complex diagnoses as well.
That's great. And we need that. So last question. Anyone who's interested in learning more about your business or learning more about you or connecting with you, where can they find you?
Our website, potentiometrics.com. Also, our cancer platform is My Cancer Journey, mycancerjourney.com.
Thank you, Bobby. It was a pleasure and very, very informational to have you on the show and talk to you about healthcare and the impact AI can make in healthcare. So, thank you for taking the time to be with us. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you so much. What you're doing is phenomenal. So thank you.
Thank you so much for being here today. If you like what you heard and are interested in more, visit us online at brainsbehind.ai and sign up for my monthly AI startup tracker. That's where I cut through the noise and bring you AI startups that are making tangible progress. Till next time, go out, be the brains behind AI.